Some years ago, a group of archaeologists found their way into a previously unopened Egyptian pyramid. As you might expect, they found their priceless treasures deep inside, but one item discovered was of particular interest to one of them. It was a kind of lyre, an ancient stringed instrument, and one of the archaeologists gently picked it up, expecting that it might turn to dust at his touch, but it was in perfect condition. He found it as solid and sound as the day that had been laid in that royal tomb thousands of years before. And then he plucked at the strings, and he produced a series of notes and chords that echoed eerily through the tunnels and corridors of the pyramid. That little group of men recorded that those chords and those notes plucked from the lyre's strings seemed to carry them down the long centuries of time and to transport them back into a bygone age, in ancient history, when that lyre had first been made and played and brought into the tomb within the pyramid. Charles Wesley was speaking to one of his Moravian friends about his conversion. He said, "I suppose I should keep it to myself." "Oh, no, you shouldn't," said his friend. "If you had 1,000 tongues, you should use every one of them to tell others of the peace that Christ has given you." And so on the very first anniversary of his conversion, Charles Wesley wrote a hymn which he entitled, "The Anniversary of My Conversion." It had 18 verses, and the first verse began, "Oh, for 1,000 tongues to sing my great Redeemer's praise." Well, our passage for study this evening, Genesis 29, begins with the first music from Jacob's conversion to God. And as we think about it, my prayer is that it will become like chords and notes, echoing down the corridors of time and taking us back to the very scene that's described and showing us that Jacob's story has a message for us, lessons for our stories, because much of which we will study contains eternal truth and has to be applied to our own lives. 3 points this evening, and the first one is purpose in living. It's been very interesting following up some of the stories of those who went forward at the recent Live Link Crusade. And I, along with other ministers in this town, received names of people who'd gone forward, and we were expected to follow them all up. And all of them have been contacted. The same has happened in the other churches here in the town. Now, I wouldn't dream of telling you anything about the response of someone who may be sitting here this evening. But I can tell you what happened when some of the inquirers who went forward were contacted. One woman, for example, had gone forward in the hopes that she might manage to get a better house from the housing executive if she had a minister to put in a word for her. And someone else went forward and then the next day regretted it and couldn't understand what had made him do such a stupid thing and refused to speak with or see anyone who called. And others didn't want to discuss it, said it was their own business. And as far as any nurture groups were concerned, they might come but haven't turned up yet. But by no means all have been like that. One married couple went forward, one of them a doctor. But when they went to their own church, they found absolutely no interest, no concern, no fellowship. So they went off to search for a church that might have some concern and interest and fellowship, and they found one. Oddly, the church they found, which happened to be the nearest church to where they lived, was one that hadn't wanted to have any part in the Live Link mission for its own particular reasons, but it has a biblical ministry, and I'm happy to say that the couple have been welcomed and, I understand, are growing in the faith. Their lives have been turned upside down. Another lady who attended didn't go forward, but she met Christ in the privacy of her own home a few weeks later, and after a whole lifetime of wondering and struggling and searching after God, she's come dramatically through to full assurance and great peace. Now, I've received statistics of the numbers who came forward throughout the whole of Ireland, Scotland, England, and Wales, and I have to say I'm not very interested. But what is of interest to me, however, is those whose lives have been truly changed and who are now showing that complete change by a different direction in their living. What does that mean? The first verse of Genesis 29 tells us. It reads, "Then Jacob continued on his journey and came to the land of the eastern peoples." Any half-decent commentary on Genesis 29 will tell you that that's a very inadequate translation. The first few words literally are, "Then Jacob lifted up his feet." Until now, his journey, you remember, has been a hazardous one, a frightening experience. Jacob, remember, was running away from Esau, who'd sworn to kill him for the rotten trick Jacob had played on him, stealing his inheritance. Virtually empty-handed, Jacob was running away, escaping from Esau's anger. Would Esau follow him? Would he spring an ambush and take him by surprise in some lonely valley or pass and wreak his revenge by killing him? Jacob's thoughts hadn't been very happy. Hurrying along, maybe changing tack and altering direction from time to time, he'd been journeying with backward glances, looking over his shoulder to see if he was being followed or shadowed. His brother's anger haunted him. He travelled with a weight on his mind. He'd been a very worried man. But these words, "Then Jacob lifted up his feet," are deliberately telling us something. They are telling us that things have dramatically changed. There is a new confidence in the man. There's a new hope in his heart, a new purpose in his living. It isn't that he feels he's shaken off Esau as the distance between himself and his home grows by the hour and he feels safer. Not that at all. What is being expressed is that he has passed through Bethel, the house of God. God has stepped into his life in the most dramatic way. That dream with the stairway that reached from heaven to earth. Those words that God had spoken to him. The complete surrender of his life to God the next morning. The vows that he had made. All this added up to a conversion that was true and genuine and real. And that was going to make this man into a new person. Even though that process was going to take God a whole lifetime to complete. There hadn't been any evangelist there. There hadn't been a call to come forward. There hadn't been even any counseling or follow-up classes, but Jacob had been converted all right. Make no mistake about that. He had surrendered everything to God. He had prayed the simple prayer, "Lord, I've heard your voice. I've heard your call. Here I am. I give myself entirely to you. Take my life and make it your own from now. I'll be yours to obey and serve you forever." And he meant it. It was real all right. And so we read that he continued on his journey, literally, that he lifted up his feet, meaning that there was a new purpose in him, a new spring in his step, a new firmness on his face, a new hope in his heart, a new confidence in his bearing, a purpose in his living. He had something to live for, something that was so great that no one could ever have a greater purpose for. For the Almighty, the Lord, from this day on, was going to be his guide, his God, and his guard. And it's something of that which is expressed in the unusual, in the Hebrew, and deceptively simple detail that he lifted up his feet, translated, he continued on his journey. Now, what is important in any experience is the difference it's going to make in our living. It's easy to whip up feelings. It's comparatively easy to move people to sing their heads off. It's easy enough if you have the talent to get people to laugh, or to cry, or to be sad, or to be happy. But all of that might be no better than a night out at the pictures or the theatre. What no human orator or crowd manipulator can do is to turn a man's life round, a woman's life round, to such an extent that from that day on there is a complete change. And that is only something that God can do. Being in the Holy Land was a wonderful experience, we say, or flying in a helicopter was something I've always wanted to do. It was a marvelous experience. But this was far more than just an experience. This was a revolution. I'd go as far as to say regeneration. That means a new birth. And that means a new life. And that is what we all need. Not an emotional orgy. Not a sentimental showering of the head. There's so much cynicism about today, and these shallow experiences mean nothing, or they wear off, and you get housewives who are bored with their lovely homes, or young people who are fed up with entertainment and the surfeit of free time and pleasure, or men who've grown deeply discontented with their whole lives. And this cynicism grins at us mockingly in so much of our modern culture. Who am I? Where am I going? What does it all mean? Is life just growing up and having kids, and then growing up and having kids, and them growing up and having kids, like one of those corridors of mirrors which goes on and on into an endless, boring future meaninglessness? Is that all? Or is there something and someone that can make sense of my life and why I'm here? See this young man striding out, lifting up his feet. He has met with God, and God has spoken to him, and God has a plan for his life, and he understands that to find that plan, he must keep in step with God, and God has promised to be with him, and that's it. And until we find that, we have nothing in value, nothing worth keeping, not even anything worth living for. But let a man or a woman find God, and they have found life. Purpose in living. But then secondly this evening, providence in living. Now, how long would it take us to travel about 450 miles? I suppose it would depend how you went, but if you went by car or bus or train, I suppose about 8 hours, more or less, maybe less. But on foot, it must have taken Jacob about 3 weeks. At last he reached the area that he recognized by the language that he'd learned from his mother, that this must be the place he's going to, his mother's birthplace. But how to find his uncle Laban, his mother's brother? And ahead he sees some shepherds sitting in the shade of some rocks with their sheep grazing in the scrub about them. And he comes up on them and approaches them and asks them where they're from. They tell him they're from Haran, his destination. He asks, do you know Laban, the grandson of Nahor? Oh, yes, they nod, yes, 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 we know Laban. Jacob next asks how things are with Laban. They tell him Laban's fine. And then they tell him, see that young girl coming over there? That's Laban's daughter. She's coming to water her sheep. She's coming here. And Jacob looks and sees 300-400 yards away a lovely young woman approaching, leading a small flock of sheep. No telephone directory to consult, no information office or police station to call on, just a group of Bedouin shepherds sitting by a well on the outskirts of a scattered town. But he struck absolutely the right spot. That was lucky, says someone. Bet he had his fingers crossed, says someone else, as if life was all a big game of tombola with a wheel spinning and coming to a standstill at some number that might be good, bad, or indifferent, just as chance will have it. Maybe it's like that with some people, but not for those whose guide and guard and God is the Lord. Things don't just happen for the Christian. Nothing just happens. There is a plan. There is a pattern. And the Christian's life is like a skillfully woven tapestry with a beautiful motif running right through it. And the whole great work of art forms the most beautiful piece of craftsmanship one could ever dream of. Our problem is that we peer at that tapestry too closely, and we can only see a little tiny bit of it. Very often it's hard to get any sense or meaning in the tiny little bit that we're looking at. And it's only after the long year, stepping back and drinking it all in, that we bless the hand that guided and the heart that planned. I'd like to think that night Jacob bowed before God before he went to sleep and said just two words. Thank you, Lord, for he'd been guided so clearly. Now, I don't think for one moment that Jacob had a wee prayer at every crossroads he came to. I believe he used plain common sense. I don't doubt that he'd asked the way many times. Had he had a map, he would have kept on consulting it. Of course he would. Because I believe that when we are walking with God, and listen to this, I believe that when we are walking with God, it's actually almost impossible to take a wrong turning. I have as strong a view of God's providence as that. We only take a wrong turning when we are deliberately disobedient. And guidance is simply a matter of stepping through the doors that God opens and keeping close to Him and turning away from the doors that He keeps shut and living a life that is clean and true and holy. I'm not saying that there won't be major decisions that are difficult at the time and can be an agony, but generally the one who walks humbly and faithfully with God will not go wrong and will arrive right at the very place at the very time that God has planned for them, just as Jacob did. It's a picture, a parable of how God directs His ways and our ways when He's given us His promise and we are living and traveling life's journey in faith and obedience. Mind you, the fact that Jacob hit on the very district, the very area, and even the very well that Laban used doesn't mean that Jacob is now a saintly holy man. Oh no, he's very much a man. God has got a lot of work to do on him. The Holy Spirit has recorded little details to let us see that he's actually still quite a lad. Why do you think he says to these shepherds, hey, how about you guys pushing off from here? Go on, clear off. Oh, it's not quite as blunt as that, but what he says, if you read the passage carefully, adds up to that. Did you notice? Why? Why does he tell them to shove off? He sees this extremely attractive girl coming. And to say he's interested in her would probably be an understatement. He's still young, he doesn't need glasses. He had been specifically told by his father to marry one of Laban's daughters, and he could see that this one of Laban's daughters was really quite something. In fact, the Hebrew of verse 17 tells us that actually she had a very, very beautiful figure. And Jacob felt his body temperature rising, and his pulse going faster and his mouth turning kind of dry. Could this lovely girl be the one that he would marry? Well, he doesn't want these weather-beaten old men sitting round watching everything he does and hearing every word he says when he meets her, and so he attempts to get them to move on. But, oh, this is far too interesting an event for these local yokels to miss. Nope, they say, shaking their heads, nope, too early to water the sheep, the cows ain't here yet. And they stubbornly sit and watch the stranger who has to carry off this romantic meeting with an audience. Verse 12 assures us that before Jacob did his gallant act and kissed Rachel, he told her he was his cousin, that he'd come to pay a visit to his uncle, who was her father. But it was nevertheless a very gallant act. He moved the stone by the well single-handed so she could see he wasn't a wimp. And then he did the job of watering the sheep for her to let her see he could handle stock as well as anyone. And then very circumspectly, I'm sure, with the grinning old shepherds unashamedly watching every move, he kissed her and shed eastern tears of joy at meeting up with his own kith and kin after weeks of journeying. In other words, God's remarkable guidance of Jacob to the very spot and just at the right moment to have this romantic meeting with his wife-to-be didn't make Jacob into a kind of holy freak. He was quite normal. What half-sensible male here would want some old men to see him kissing his girl for the first time? Of course, you'd try and engineer it a little bit better than that. At least I hope you would. And so Rachel ran home, excited at the news she had for the family, and her dad came out to meet Jacob, who'd been abandoned with Rachel's flock of sheep. And he told his story, and Laban accepted him as his guest into his home. And so we see clearly that Jacob's pathway had been marked out by God. Mums and dads are often so anxious when their son or their daughter leaves home and goes off to study or work in a strange town or city. But if their son or their daughter truly knows and loves the Lord, and if the Lord is their guide and their guard and their God, then mum and dad have no need to be afraid. Their son, their daughter will be directed by a loving father and will find friends, security, even far, far from home, because of the kind and loving providence of the Heavenly Father, providence in living. But then finally this evening, purity in living. Now, I remember chatting to an old lady once, and she told me in no uncertain terms that she had no time for the Bible. And she told me why. It was all over this horrible character, Jacob. He cheated his brother, he deceived his father, and then God ended up blessing him and making it all right. He got off scot-free. She said, I know we have to forgive. I know all that, and I agree. But that awful character, Jacob, I think he was just despicable. And I can't believe in a Bible or a God who chooses him instead of his nice brother Esau. Well, what do you say to an objection like that? There's a very easy answer. Read the story again, my dear. Only this time read the whole story. And while you read it, think. Use the brain God has given you. Well, it had been love at first sight. His mouth really had gone dry. His heart had thumped. She was just gorgeous. She was beautiful. Just his type. He was well away, madly in love. He'd only been there for 4 weeks when it came out. Laban had seen straight away that Jacob wasn't just a guest. He was an active, hard-working man and obviously an expert stockman. Well, he'd only been there 4 weeks when the truth was blurted out. Laban said, listen here, nephew. You're doing a power of work. I could do with a man like you about the place, but I'll need to pay you something. Can't we agree on a salary? Jacob had it all worked out. Poor Rebecca, his mother. You see, his mum back home had sent him just for a few weeks until Esau's anger had burned down a bit, but Jacob was too much in love to remember that and his mother, and he had his answer all ready. I'll work 7 years for the hand of your daughter Rachel in marriage. Now, in those days, men had a big price to pay to the family of the girl they married. We had 3 Kenyan girls with us a few weeks ago in August, and they told us that in Kenya, it's still that way round. The groom provides the wedding reception and gives the bride's father a huge cash payment into the bargain. And Edna tells us that Irian Jaya among the Hoopla people, it's the same there. The man has to buy his wife. Well, it was like that here. And Jacob hadn't a penny to give to Laban for Rachel, so he offered 7 years' wages for her instead. And isn't verse 20 just beautiful? Jacob loved Rachel so much that the 7 years seemed just like a few days to him. And at the end of 7 years, he came to ask Laban for his bride. Now, we need to pause just for a couple of sentences to point out that the text is quite explicit that though these two had been living in the same home, under the same roof, deeply in love for 7 years, Rachel was still a virgin. And that's important. There was a high standard of morality, and Jacob had been disciplined enough and moral and upright enough to maintain that standard. It can be done. And I can only guess that there was a strict code of etiquette, and that apart from speaking together, Jacob and Rachel hadn't had yet any kind of courtship in terms of a physical relationship. And that was why he'd been able to keep his relationship with Rachel pure all that time, though they'd loved each other 7 years. We are simply too physical nowadays. I'm quite sure of that. When one is in a crowd with Christian young people, one sees one or two couples who are just draped round each other like vines round a post slobbering and kissing in public even, most unwise, and most difficult for those who are watching on as well. The more restrained, the more careful, the more guarded the relationship, the better in the long run. Young people don't believe that nowadays, but it's true, it's absolutely true. Jacob's example in this is one that is right and proper and is to be noted carefully. Maybe more about that another time and in another place. And so the wedding day came, a grand reception, fantastic wedding and feast. And then the time came for the couple to leave and start their honeymoon, and the bride, heavily veiled, left with the groom. No minister had said, "Now would the groom please kiss the bride?" No bridesmaid had set forward to remove the heavy veil which completely concealed the blushing girl. And so off the couple went to the bridal suite, lighted only by a spluttering oil lamp. But in the morning, Jacob discovered he had been cheated, for his bride, hiding behind that heavy veil, had not been Rachel at all, but Leah. And Jacob, frankly, was not turned on by Leah one little bit. To say Jacob was angry is putting it mildly, but crafty Laban was all ready for him. He'd a trumped-up story about the older girl always being married first and said, "Live with Leah for 7 days, and then we'll have another wedding, and you can have Rachel as well." And so 7 days later, Jacob ended up with two wives, the two sisters, one of whom he loved passionately, and one of whom he didn't want. And the problem was that poor Leah loved Jacob all right. She loved him very, very deeply. The pathetic story of the names that she gave her four sons tells us that. Why did Laban pull this fast one on Jacob? That's the point. Well, first, he was a true brother of Jacob's mother. And remember that the deception Jacob had worked on Esau and Isaac had been masterminded by Laban's sister, Jacob's mother Rebekah. That's the first point. The second point is that crafty Laban was now to get another 7 years' free work out of poor Jacob. Jacob was cornered, he had no option. 14 years' work for no wages except the two sisters. He hadn't quite intended a bargain as hard as that. But the third point is the most important. It is that God was beginning a work of purifying this man's life. You see, Jacob had cheated Esau. He'd cheated Isaac. He'd taken advantage of Esau's greed on another occasion, and now the birds were coming home to roost. God was teaching him a lesson, a most painful lesson, that whatever we sow, that we reap. Now don't fall into the trap of saying that God was punishing Jacob for his past sins. God never punishes his children for past sins, never. Punishment in the Bible sense means retribution. The just deserts for our deeds which are weighed in the balance, and ruthless penalties are meted out. No, God does not punish his children. If we were punished, it would mean death. And Jesus paid it all. That is foundational. But God does apply discipline to our lives. And I'm not playing with words. The distinction between punishment on the one hand and discipline on the other is a most important one. God was chastening, was disciplining Jacob, beginning a process of purifying him, purging from him the twist in his character. I was once shown round a foundry where castings for different parts of car engines were made, and I saw the huge containers of molten metal, white hot, and watch that liquid metal being poured into the sand mouldings to make sumps for British Leyland cars. Outside the foundry was a dump which had to be continually cleared away. It was the dump for the hardened dross, which had been scooped off the molten metal to purify it. And as I think of Jacob's rage, his broken heart to find he'd been tricked into marrying a girl he didn't even like, his tears, his frustration that he must work another 7 years for no pay, the way he'd been taken advantage of, I sense the heat, the great heat, melting his inner man so that God could scoop off some of the pride and the selfishness that resided deep within him. Now, do you see why I told the old lady to go back to her Bible and read the story of Jacob again? And this is but the beginning. There's more to come. There's more discipline to come, more chastening to come, and it goes on and on and on until we find at the end of his life a holy man, humble and gentle and upright, and who has learned to do to his neighbor as he would have his neighbor do to him. God's purpose for our living, God's providence in our living, God's purity through our living. Our lives are to become a lyre, an instrument which the very fingers of God can pluck, so that sweet and lovely strains of music, pleasing chords, should echo through the corridors of our living. Have you come to know the Lord Jesus? Have you given yourself to him? Then expect God to have a purpose for you, to guide you gently in his providence, and to begin a work in you to purify you, and until the testimony of your life and mine, as well as of our lips, brings honor and glory to his name.